There we go. That's on me. I didn't turn it on. Yeah, I swiped this before John gave it to me. I wasn't ready. Good morning. It's great to see you. Man, that doesn't mean I get to start my stopwatch over. That was my fault. Shoot. Okay, yeah, it's good to see all of you here this morning. We have some visitors with us, and it's wonderful to see all of you here. I got to hear Briley before I saw him, so that was a good surprise. Yeah, it's been wonderful to see all of you here this morning. There's a song that we sing sometimes that goes, "This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid out somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." This is one of my favorite songs. It's one of my favorite songs because it reminds me of singing it in Gainesville. It's one that we sing fairly often, it seems, whenever we used to go down for Hootin' and Hollerin' and things like that. But more and more, I find that this is a song that I resonate with. I resonate with. I can't feel at home in this world anymore, and maybe you do as well. The older I get, the more I feel like this world actually isn't my home, because your home is a place where you can kick your feet up, you know, you can take your shoes off. It's a place where you can relax and be comfortable. But the older I get, and the more time that I spend at Missouri State, the more I feel like I have to have my guard up, and maybe you feel this way as well. The more that I pay attention to the news, the more I realize that maybe this place isn't one in which I should feel comfortable or familiar. The world is a changing place, and more often, as time goes on, it feels like we can't maybe feel at home in this world. And this has sort of been the underlying theme of our study in the book of Daniel. Because Daniel and his friends, they are living in exile. They're not living in their home. They're living far from it. And what we've been doing as we've been walking through the book of Daniel is we've been asking various questions about what it may look like for us to live in the world that we live in and it not be our home, right? And so two weeks ago, we looked at Daniel chapter 1, and we realized that one of the things that we need to do, that we need to be mindful of, are drawing lines and setting boundaries. And at the very least, we didn't get maybe an explicit answer as to what that might look like in each individual case, but at the very least, one of the things that we saw is that there is a certain amount of wisdom in drawing lines, that there is wisdom and that there is a lot of benefit in removing ourselves to a certain extent from our world, right? Creating these little markers of identity, saying this is this line for me, right? Maintaining our identity. But that also there is a deep wisdom and there is a lot of benefit in still existing in our world, living in it, going to work, right? Having a vested interest in our world and letting our light shine. And that we each have to go into our world and have the wisdom to figure out where that line is, right, in each case. And then last week, what we talked about, what we looked at, was what it may look like for us to reveal truth in our world. We looked at what exactly our truth is. We looked at the story of Nebuchadnezzar and his dream that he has. And for Daniel, he's put in this unique position where he is the only person in Nebuchadnezzar's life that can tell him the truth, that can reveal the truth of his dream to him. And we revealed that part of the Christian truth that we are supposed to share in our world is unpleasant. It's a nightmare, right? Because Nebuchadnezzar's dream is that everything that he's worked for and built, that it is fading away, right? That it will be destroyed, and that there will be kingdoms that come after him, and that ultimately everything will be wiped away, right? And that's an uncomfortable truth. But that there's another part of this, that part of the truth that we're supposed to share with our world is that one day, that there will be a rock that's not cut from human hands, right? That will come and it will destroy these kingdoms of the earth, and it already has, and that rock will grow into an everlasting kingdom, that God is establishing his rule and his kingdom here on earth, and it's one that we can attach ourselves to and that we can have confidence in. That it will never end. That's a beautiful, beautiful thing to have to share with our world. And today what we're going to look at is Daniel chapter 3, our God in the fire. We're going to look at what it might look like to stand in defiance to our world. And we'll go ahead and jump right in now that I've wasted a good portion of our time with our mic off. Daniel chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, if you'll read with me. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth was 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image that the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers and the justices and the magistrates and all the officials of the province gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that he had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as the people heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, bagpipe, harp, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This morning what we're going to look at is the object of our defiance, the attitude of our defiance, and the company of our defiance. First of all, let's look at the object of our defiance. Here in this chapter, chapter 3 of Daniel, what is it exactly that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are rebelling against? And what is it that we should be rebelling against and defying in our world? Well, put very simply, in the context of this chapter, it's the image, right? And the worship of the image, of course. But what is the image? In order for us to understand this image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up, we have to go back to last week. So if you remember last week, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And in his dream, there was a statue, presumably a statue of himself, right? And the statue had a head of gold, right, and a chest of silver, a waist of bronze, legs of iron, and then feet of iron and clay. And he was told in the dream that these parts of the statue, that they represented kingdoms. Daniel said, "Your kingdom, O Nebuchadnezzar, is the head of gold." Right? But after your kingdom is gone, there'll be another one that rises after you that's inferior to yours, and then there'll be another one, and there'll be another one. And ultimately, there'll be another one with the feet, and it'll be brittle. Right? It won't be mixed quite together quite well. And that eventually, something will come and destroy all of these kingdoms. Now, what's so interesting about this is that Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and Daniel tells him the truth of the dream. That your kingdom, this head of gold, will end, right? And that ultimately God will establish a kingdom that will not end, right? That you'll be able to be a part of. And then in chapter 3, what Nebuchadnezzar does is he builds a statue that looks like this. Right? Isn't that, like, what peculiar behavior? Nebuchadnezzar creates a statue, and it doesn't look like this because this is a trine. Nebuchadnezzar creates a statue. And what is it made out of? Well, it's all gold, right? It's all gold. In a sense, Nebuchadnezzar is having one of the biggest, like, midlife crises of his day, right? And what is he saying? Like, what's the message of the statue, right? In context with the dream, Daniel, you say that my kingdom will end, right? That my kingdom of gold that was the head will end. I'm telling you, my kingdom will never end. The whole statue is gold, right? It's not a statue that's made up of different kingdoms. It's all gold, right? The metal which represented his kingdom. It is a statue and a kingdom that will never end, right? That will never leave the face of the earth. And Nebuchadnezzar, after setting up the statue with this message that his kingdom, that this thing that he has established will never fade, right, will never go away, that it is the ultimate thing, the eternal thing, he asks all of his subjects in his kingdom to do one thing, and that is to acknowledge this statement that he has made. And essentially, I think this is the age-old expectation of our world. It's the expectation that we should worship and devote our lives to things that are ultimately meaningless, that are transient, that are fading away. And you can pay attention to this, like, because the same sort of language gets mirrored, right? Sometimes in our lives, I'll never forget. You get a lot of FedEx stories. You're gonna get another one. I'm sorry, but I'll never forget. There's one time when we were working at FedEx. We're all in the warehouse, and this is in and around like COVID time, you know, and so things are sort of shaky. And I remember our manager came out on the dock, and he had sort of gathered us all around, and we were all slightly annoyed by this. And he gave us a very rousing speech. And at the end of the speech, he said, you know, guys, you don't have to worry because we're not going anywhere, right? Like FedEx is not going anywhere, right? Like it was this sort of thing, right? And what was the message, right? It's like this is something that you can dedicate time to, that you can dedicate your life to, that you can make your career because this is not going anywhere, right? And this is just one example. Right? Our world, and we've already sort of talked about this in previous weeks, are full of things that are trying to get our attention, right? Things that our world wants us to dedicate our lives to and to worship. Things that our world wants to make our ultimate thing. And the message that's being communicated is the same as the one that's being communicated here. That these things that we have an opportunity to dedicate our lives to, our time to, our attention to, our focus to, that they're never going away, right? That they are ultimate things. That they're things like this, strong, right? That will last. And we need to do a good job at recognizing this. There are several ways to. I want to give you an example of one. A few years ago, it was my freshman year of college, and I remember I was sitting in a drive-thru at McDonald's, which was actually pretty common. Most of my freshman year of college was spent sitting in a drive-thru at McDonald's, unfortunately. But I remember I was reading an email. I had seen this email, and it was 2 days old. And the email said this. I opened it up, and the email said, "Hey, this is from your professor, you know. Hey, remember that semester-long paper that we've been talking about that's worth like 30% of your grade? Don't forget, class, that that's due tomorrow." And I was reading this 2 days late because I was nervous to open the email, which is, you know, I shouldn't have waited. And I remember sitting there in this drive-thru, reading that I had just missed the deadline of this like semester-long project that was worth 30% of my grade that I hadn't thought about since day one of the class. And I remember I got reasonably upset, right? And then I got unreasonably upset, right? I got like insanely like angry at myself. I was incredibly frustrated. I just completely broke down, and it took like I immediately emailed the professor. You know, I was angry at myself. I drove off to work. I was just like incredibly frustrated. I was crushed, right? I was destroyed. And I emailed my professor, and he'd like emailed me back in like 30 seconds and said, "Yeah, that's fine. Just turn it in later today." And I got a chance to like take a step back and like cool down and go, oof, you know, like that was pretty unreasonable, right? And it's one thing that when you see like your grade drop from like, you know, an A to a C in like 30 seconds essentially of your life, to get reasonably upset, and it's one thing for you to just get absolutely destroyed, right? And for your world to come crashing down around you. And we have these sort of instances in our lives, right, where it gets revealed maybe what is functioning as our ultimate thing, right? Because to me, When my GPA was put in jeopardy, I didn't get reasonably upset. I got unreasonably upset. And why? Because it was functioning like this. Because my ultimate thing had been touched, right? It had been messed with, right? The thing that I was dedicating time to, the thing that in my mind would never leave the earth, right? It was an ultimate thing. We need to do a good job of identifying these in our lives. What is the object of our defiance? Well, it's to look at these sorts of things that we can dedicate our lives to, that are not worth our time and our energy and our lives, and to say, no, we will not bow to those things. Right? That only one thing will function as the most important thing, the ultimate thing in our life, and that thing will be God. That's the object of our defiance. This is the object of our defiance. Now, what is the attitude of our defiance? Put simply, not bowing to the various idols in our world, it has consequences. It has real consequences. Look at down in verse 16. Verse 16. So Nebuchadnezzar, he sets up the statue. He sets up this thing that's important to him, his kingdom. And he says, all of you are going to bow to my kingdom. And you can have your gods. You can have your things that are important to you. But when I play the music, you will bow. Right? This is the idea. And the music plays, and this situation occurs, and three people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, did not bow, and so he brings them in. And in verse 16, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king. They said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. There's another important aspect of this idol worship that we see in Daniel chapter 3, and it's one that still resonates with us today, and it's that when the music plays, we're expected to bow, right? And that is that situations occur in our lives where, like the rubber meets the road, and it'll be our decision either to bow to the idols of our world or not to. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are put in a situation and they don't bow. But what they say here in verse 18, I think, is very important. But if not, if God doesn't come out and save us, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And as we read this passage, one thing that we have to do is have reverence for literally millions of Christians who have echoed those words and who were then subsequently torn to pieces for their faith, right? We have to recognize that. In the history of our world, there are real consequences for not bowing, and there are real consequences here. They're thrown into the fiery furnace. We should recognize this story, I think, almost as an outlier, and we shouldn't doubt God's ability. We should continue to stand for Him, not expecting Him to sort of come out of the clouds and to save us necessarily, knowing that if we did, that if this was our expectation, it might mean a little bit less. And I want to maybe give you another example of this and what this looks like. Not bowing to the images of our world is a sacrifice. It really is. You remember the story from 1 Samuel chapter 15, the story of Saul. And Saul is ordered by God to completely destroy the Amalekites. You remember? These were an evil, evil people. These were people who Not only were they brutal sort of warlords in the area, but they were people who regularly practiced child sacrifice and all of this sort of stuff. And God commands Saul to go and to wipe out the Amalekites, to just destroy everything, right? And Saul's met in this with this situation, right? He has a decision to make, and it's one that's a sacrifice for him, because destroying everything means like destroying the sheep, right? And destroying like the wealth, right, that he could gain from this. And instead, what he does is he kills the people, right? But he saves the king, and he saves the sheep, and he saves the wealth, right? So that he can gain from it. And when Samuel approaches him from the distance, Saul comes out and says, "I've done everything that the Lord has asked me to do." And Samuel says, "Then what is the bleating of sheep that I hear?" Right? And what's the situation that Saul was put in? Well, following God and doing what God had asked him to do in that situation meant doing something that didn't make any sense to him. Right? It meant not gaining from this like battle that he had had, right? And not following God, not doing what God had asked him to do in this situation, meant like accumulating wealth, right, and building himself up. And it meant keeping the king and becoming a king of kings and becoming more powerful. And Saul does all of that. He chooses this path. Not bowing, following what God has asked us to do, and following how God would ask us to live, you know. And our lives means sacrifice a lot of times. And sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we forget that Abraham, who completely uprooted his family to follow God, when he died, his descendants were not as numerous as the stars. He had a few children. And when he died, the only portion of the promised land that he actually owned was the cave that he was buried in, right? Sometimes when we follow God in our lives, it will mean putting ourselves seemingly at a disadvantage, and there will be consequences to that. And sometimes the prosperity that we are promised in the end are things that we will never see in this life. And they know that. Because sometimes following God and choosing to make Him our ultimate thing and to worship Him means being honest. And sometimes being honest doesn't get us ahead, right? And there are numerous different examples we could drag out about this, but the idea is very clear that here, what's notable about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is they recognize God's ability to bring them through this difficult circumstance, to bring them through and to not cause them to face the consequences of not bowing. And they recognize God's ability to save them from the world around them, but they don't expect him to, and they're willing to serve him even if it means death, even if it means inconvenience, even if it means discomfort. And I wonder if we're willing to do the same. We should. Lastly, here, the company of our defiance. This is an important point. Here, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you'll notice, they're not saved from going into the fire, right? They're not saved from going into the fire. They go into the furnace, just like Nebuchadnezzar told them they would. And they go into the furnace, I imagine, fully expecting to be destroyed, but they aren't. And if you think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in this situation, just put yourself in their shoes, right? They stand up to Nebuchadnezzar and they say, "Nebuchadnezzar, we know that God can save us from the furnace. He can save us from you. But even if he doesn't, we won't follow you anyway. We won't worship your gods." And maybe they say that, and deep down they're thinking, "Yeah, but man, it would be really great if he did," right? And then, okay, the guards come and they start binding them, and they're thinking, "Okay, now would be a really great time for God to like show up and save me from this. Maybe like this is a Samson situation. I'm able to like break through and we run away. It's, you know, everything's great." And then the guards pick them up and they're thinking, "Okay, getting a little close to the wire here. Now would be a really great time for you to save me, God." And they're walking to the fire, And then the guards are dying because it's really hot, and they're like, okay, now would be a really good time. And then they get thrown into the fire. And they're probably thinking all hope is lost. God didn't show up. And just when they think that all hope is lost, they find that even though they were not saved from going into the fire, that they are sustained in the fire. And how does this happen? Because in their torment, in the heat of the fire, they are met by the Son of God. Look down at verse 23. And these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste. And he declared to his counselors, Did we not cast three bound men into the fire? And they answered the king, This is true. And he answered and said, But I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. The appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Our God does not save us from going into the fire. Our God doesn't save us from going and experiencing the fires of life. But He does sustain us in the fire. Right? And how does He do it? Well, some of you know what it's like to experience disaster, to experience fire in your life, and to experience also the presence of a friend in your life. Right? You know what sort of comfort that can bring, and you know the way that that can sustain you, right? And what we should know, we've already discussed the millions of Christians who have died for their faith throughout the years. One thing that we should know is that in their torment, in their fire, in the disaster and the tragedy of their life, that they were met by the ultimate friend, by this one who is like the Son of God. One thing that we should be certain of is that in their affliction, Jesus was present, and that they met Him face to face. And that in our affliction, when we go into the fires of life, either because of the decisions that we've made to follow God or not, that we are met with Jesus in our fire. That because Jesus, on the cross, experienced physical agony, that when we cry out to God, my God, why have you forsaken me? We can know that we are crying, that we are echoing the death cries of Christ. And we know that Jesus on the cross experienced the full weight, the full cup of God's judgment, so that when we enter the fires of life, we can know that one like the Son of God stands beside us. He knows our affliction, right? And He's with us in it. That's an important thing to remember. And God meets us in our fires individually, one-on-one in His spiritual presence in our life and the way that we feel, knowing that He was there in the garden, that He knows what that's like. And He meets us in the face of one another. Right? This is an important thing for us to remember. We have the Brumfields with us here this morning, and it was just a few years ago that I went through a fire, and the Brumfields were there for me. Right? And they quit their jobs, and they're like, were there with me in the fire, and that was not just their love, but that was Jesus' love. Right? Standing in the midst of the fire, right? That allowed us all to be able to sort of sustain that. And that's a continual thing. One thing that we should remember always is that God is with us in the fires and trials of life. He sustains us in them. This is the object of our defiance, the thing that we should stand against. We should stand against our world's attempts to make us and to cause us to devote our lives to things that aren't worth our time. And we should recognize when we are doing that. We should do it also knowing that sometimes following God carries consequences, right? Uncomfortable consequences. Not bowing to the idols of our world has consequences. But we should do so knowing and having the confidence that when we experience fires and we're thrown into the furnace, that there is one who walks in the furnace with us. He's one like the Son of God. If you would like this sort of confidence, if you would like to put on Christ in baptism, if you would like to meet Jesus in the waters of baptism so that he can meet you in the fires of life, we invite you to do so while we stand and sing.